This is a recording of the Michael Lerner teleconference with Common Wheel on November 6, 2006 at 12 p.m. Central Time. Mr. Lerner, I have one after, so you may begin whenever you're ready.
Okay, great. Okay. Who else has joined the call? Anybody other than Neil and Charlotte Brody?
Aaron Jacobs.
Great, welcome.
This is Michael.
This is Theo. Welcome, Theo.
Hey, can you all speak a little louder? We're having trouble hearing you today.
Well, we'll do our best. Is that better?
Ian Carey.
Welcome.
Dan Magnuson.
Welcome.
Lynn Cannon.
Welcome.
Nancy McCauley.
Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you.
Anybody else join?
Tony Marthaler.
Welcome, Tony.
Yep. Michael, did you catch Phil and Alice Shabakov?
Hey, welcome, Phil.
Thanks.
And Alice.
Hello. Welcome, Alice.
Thank you.
When's your book out, Phil and Alice?
The question is, when are we going to finish it?
Oh.
Not finishing the first draft.
Well, we're all right. Waiting with bated breath.
Right. You didn't know you were nagging, Michael, did you?
We nag ourselves plenty.
Phil, hello, this is Dan Goldman.
Hi, Dan.
Looking forward
to your presentation.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to your book. I'm not nagging. I'm just saying I'm looking forward.
Anybody else join us?
This is Carla Fortunato.
Welcome, Carla.
Deb Moore.
Welcome, Deb.
Hi. Cheryl Patton.
Welcome, Cheryl.
Hi.
A.T. Birmingham Young.
Welcome. Great. Well, let's get started here. Julia, do you want to do the introduction now, and then we'll start in.
Okay. Thanks, Michael. Welcome, everyone. My name is Julia Varshavsky, and I'm pleased to welcome you to today's teleconference. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yep.
With author Daniel Goldman, who's speaking today on social intelligence and environmental health. Michael will be moderating this call, and I'll turn it over to him in just a second. I just wanted to quickly point out that we have some useful resources today on the CHE website pertaining to the call. We have a live blog and also a link to Daniel Goldman's website. And you can use the blog to post comments and questions to during the call, either while listening over the phone or over the live audio stream, which you can also do for free. The CHE staff, including me, Michael, and Frida Nixdorf, are monitoring the blog during the call, and no special software other than a connection to the Internet is required. So we really encourage you to use the blog. And you can access that and the live audio stream link and other resources at the CHE website at www.healthandenvironment.org, which is healthandenvironment.org. And under the What's New box on the left-hand side, you can see a link to today's call. Okay, so before we begin, I'd like to cover some logistical information regarding the call. Everyone that is on the call will be put into a listen-only mode by our operator in just a second. And then at the conclusion of the presentations, I'll ask the operator to unmute all of the lines, so that you can participate in a question and answer period if you choose, at which time we ask that you please use the mute function on your phone if you have one, if you're not speaking, so that we don't hear all the ambient noise from all of our phones. If not, you can also, if you don't have a mute function, you can also press *6 to mute or unmute yourself during that time. Don't use the hold button on your phone because that tends to play music on the call. Okay, so this call will last 1 hour. It is being recorded, and an audio MP3 file will be available on the website, the CHE website, for downloading within the next few days. And as always, I'll send out a notice of that and other information pertaining to today's call in the coming days. So with that, I will go ahead and turn it over to Michael.
Thank you, Julia. And Dan, it's an honor and a pleasure to do this conversation with you. I've been immersed in your book, Social Intelligence. We've known each other since before you wrote your groundbreaking book, Emotional Intelligence, and actually participated in conferences that led up to the community of work that framed the context of your first book. And as I read your new book, Social Intelligence, it strikes me that it's really an argument for compassion at almost every level, and an argument that the new social neuroscience demonstrates the importance of compassion at every level. You suggest that we're wired to connect, that the brain is essentially sociable, and that we're inexorably drawn into intimate brain-to-brain link-up when we engage with others. And in very beautiful and exquisite ways, you describe how our relationships mold our biology, and that while emotional intelligence in 1995 was focused on our inner capacities to manage our relationship, the science then has enabled you to describe the social neuroscience of interaction. So that's sort of just a beginning piece here. But I also know that you share our profound interest in the interaction of the environment and health. And I'd like to open just by giving you an opportunity to talk about where you see some of those interactions, and then we will go on from there.
Sure. Thank you, Michael. As always, you're so eloquent. People on the call may not know I've known you for a couple decades, and you're still one of my role models, so it's a pleasure to be doing this with you. Let me give some context for conversation that draws on what's in the new book and also in the emotional intelligence book and subsequent research into what the underlying neural circuitry is for our emotional intelligence, which strictly defined would be self-awareness, sensing our feelings, our values, our knowing why we're feeling what we're feeling, as well as managing emotions, both being able to handle distressing emotions so that we can do what we need to, and yet and also channel positive emotions to motivate, use, and keep us interested. Those are intrapersonal abilities, and they've been talked about for a long time. Howard Gardner has a model of seven intelligence where he talks about those. What was new in 95 when I wrote the book was the neural underpins for those abilities, because of the new work back then in affective neuroscience. What moved me to write social intelligence was an emerging field that Michael mentioned, social neuroscience, which has expanded the unit of analysis in neuroscience from one brain and one body, one person, to two. In other words, it's a neuroscience of relationship, and it, as Michael says, it has lots of implications for compassion, for understanding why things go wrong in relationships. One of the, for me, most profound take-homes from the neuroscience is that we are not just wired to connect, but that we are constantly connecting physiologically whenever we interact. The discovery of mirror neurons, which act like a neural Wi-Fi, tells us that whenever we're with someone, or even on the phone, a tone of voice, facial expression, movement, intention, we have neurons that are designed to pick that up and to activate in our brain precisely what's being activated in the other person's brain, which creates an immediate understanding of what's going on. This is what keeps our interactions on course. This is what makes people able to help each other when they're distressed, for example, calm down just by mere presence. Now, that's general context. For purposes of this call, I'd like to look at the developmental aspect of both of those sets of circuits, that is, the circuits that allow us to be self-aware and manage emotions, and the circuits that allow social intelligence, which is empathy and skill in interacting, because there's something very importantly different about these circuits in evolution and in child development. That is that these are the last parts of the brain to come online in evolution, and because ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, these are the last circuits of the brain to become fully mature anatomically. They don't reach their final growth until mid-20s. And Because of the new understanding in genetics that genes are designed not just to be had, but to be expressed or not, this is called epigenetics, that genes are meant to be acted on by the environment. And if the environment triggers a gene to express itself, then it matters that it exists. If it never does, then we may as well not have it. It turns out that the social and emotional circuitry of the brain is extremely responsive to the environment developmentally. It's so responsive that it's one of the few circuits of the brain that we now know is acted on genetically by relationships. If a and the prototypic research is done in lab mice, but the mammalian brain shares the same circuitry. If a rat mom is nurturing and takes care of the pups, that's expressed by licking and grooming in that case, then the circuitry of the HPA axis, which is the trigger point for stress hormones and the stress response, becomes quite resilient, meaning that it's less likely to be activated by new and novel things, only by threat, genuine threat, and that when it, you do have a stress response, it recovers more quickly. So that's an optimal way for that particular circuitry to operate in humans as well as in other mammals. If, however, instead of nurturing parenting, instead there's a deficit, in the rat case, it would be the absence of anything, or a mother who doesn't pay much attention. And in the human case, all the other iterations of parents not being there for kids, not being empathic, not being responsive. Then the HPA axis is triggered differently at the genetic level, and the pup becomes hyper-reactive, very timid, reacts to anything new and novel as though it were a threat, freezes, doesn't explore the environment. Once the stress response is triggered, it takes a long, long time to recover to baseline. Now, what's interesting to me is that it's very unusual for social interaction to be what's the active ingredient epigenetically. Much more often, it's chemicals. It's chemicals from things we eat and from things we breathe. Any way that that vector can start inside the body. And I suspect, and this is my hunch, maybe people on the call know of data, but if you look at the deficits that accrue when the circuitry doesn't get what it needs developmentally, you see things in children like attentional problems, cognitive deficits, problems in emotional self-management, behavioral problems, and at the extreme, the circuitry of the social brain is the precise set of neuronal arrays that is the site of deficits in autism and Asperger's. And we know that seemingly there's been an epidemiological explosion in the last few decades in kids with problems in these disorders. This range of problems. And I've been active, as Michael mentioned earlier, the two of us were involved in a group which has now given rise to something called social-emotional learning, which are curricula that seek to give kids the training they need in the classroom for what they didn't get at home to make up for deficits in behavior and emotional self-management and empathy and social skills and so on. But that is just treating the symptom, and I think it would be more to the point to treat the cause. And my hunch is that a lot of the cause will turn out to be exactly in the domain that you all are dealing with. So, Michael, that was what I wanted to say at the outset. And as you know, I want to get also to the message question, but maybe later.
Right. And you're speaking to a group of people who are finely attuned to the argument that you're making. Let me make two quick points on it. The first is that Theo Colburn and Pete Myers and Diane Dumanoski wrote a book that's one of the Bibles of our field. Theo, I know, is on the call, and Pete and Diane might also be, called Our Stolen Future. And Theo's original observations on endocrine disruption in Great Lakes birds and other species demonstrated that under the impact of endocrine disruption, that many of these animals lost their, you know, capacity to nurture their young. And so that was a very important observation in the wild. And then speaking of autism and Asperger's, the last 4 days, Charlotte Brody and I had been at two conferences on autism and Asperger's, and what Martha Herbert, a great Harvard neuroscientist, describes as the new paradigm of autism. Autism was originally, of course, thought to be a purely psychological construct of the refrigerator mom. Then it became a purely genetic construct with no environmental input. And now the new paradigm says exactly what you're suggesting, namely that there are important environmental triggers that are contributing to the expression of genes, or certainly whether or not it's the mechanism is that way, that there are environmental factors that are leading to the development of Asperger's and autism in many children. So I think, Dan, that one of the most important things that really depth immersion of our field in your work on social intelligence will contribute to us is that in our model of what we call ecological health, which is our recognition, we sort of started with a focus on toxic chemicals, but we increasingly recognized that toxic chemicals were in profound interaction with diet, with stress, with all kinds of other factors. But we usually refer to to stress simply as stress. And what you enable us to do is to disarticulate both the concept of stress and the concept of nurturance and the ratio of stress and nurturance and resilience in ways that I think are profoundly important and scientifically based for our field. I'd like to ask you, just because it's such a striking example, we've been talking at a level of abstraction, but your description of the three coping styles that many people have and how that works out in long-term couple relationships is one of the more vivid descriptions on in your book. And just to descend from the abstract to the specific, can you describe how these three coping styles in couple relationships sculpt us, how we are mutually sculpted in our most intimate relationships over time?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's a surprising question, too. But anyway, let me start with how we come to have distinct styles of relating to distressing emotion. It starts in childhood, and it turns out that parenting style predicts adult style of relating to emotion in relationships. So to start with the kid case, if you have parents who empathize with you, attend well, are nurturing, responsive, help you calm down when you're upset, and you have what John Bowlby, the psychoanalyst, called a secure base, and you'll have a secure attachment style, as it's called in adulthood, meaning that you don't overreact when something goes wrong with your partner. If you have a parenting style if the parents have a style that upsets you, for example, you come in upset and angry, and your parent yells at you, "Don't you be angry with me," and the interaction ends there. You never learn how to metabolize those emotions, which is one of the main jobs of parenting, helping kids understand how to handle emotions. And that's one of the kinds of interactions that in adulthood leads to what's called sometimes called an anxious attachment style. Michael, these were the ones you're asking about, right?
Yes, right.
Yeah. And anxious, if you have an anxious style, you scan for signs of rejection, abandonment, belittlement, and because these were things that you had to scan for in childhood in order to feel safe and secure. And as a result, you enact with your partner what you learned to do when you were a kid, which often has disastrous results, or it's very confusing to partners, or leads to Sturm und Drang in relationship. The third style is what's called the avoidance style, and this arises in a kind of stiff upper lip family where parents ignore a child's emotions, and the child learns to ignore his or her emotions, and you, as a consequence, are very uncomfortable in adulthood with disturbing emotions of any kind, whether your own or someone else's, and you step back, you withdraw, either actually or attentionally. And so it means that you don't ever bring up anything that needs to be dealt with, for example, because it might be too upsetting. Or if you happen to have an anxious partner, you have a situation where the anxious partner is overreacting, and that makes the avoidant partner withdraw. And one of the classic scenarios in couples therapy actually is the anxious avoidant couple. So, Michael, anyway, that's the pitch.
I think it just brings it down to, you know, to sort of concrete reality from the abstraction at which we were focused. And the book, as I read it, you go from childhood interactions to couple interactions, and then you go to broader groups, to our work and social communities, and up from that to institutions. The beautiful quote from Aldous Huxley, in which he calls institutions organized lovelessness. And so you address at each level, you know, can we educate ourselves to social intelligence as individuals? What would it take to create humane institutions? And then on up to issues of racism and genocide and those kinds of questions. What would it take to avoid you know, those horrible situations? So the book is organized as a sort of a set of interlocking examples of social intelligence from childhood and individual, you know, dyadic relationships up to the global level.
That's right. What I like to do is look at the emergent properties from one level to the next, to the next, to the next.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you mention is the well-known work by Robert Putnam on bowling alone, and the evidence that the number of intimate relationships that most people report in the United States has been declining over time. Could you say a little more about that and the implications of that for our health?
Well, at the same time, sociologists are documenting an erosion of the number and quality of close relationships in people's lives, whether with family or friends or clubs or church or whatever. People in social epidemiology and health are noting that the more that's true of you, the less likely you are to live longer or to recover quickly from serious illness or to be healthy. So the two things seem to be going hand in hand, kind of a breakdown of social ties. At the same time, that very breakdown in social ties seems to correlate with a breakdown in health.
And there's a point at which you talk about, I forget what specific toxic interaction, but you speak literally of toxic interactions, and you talk about their impact on health being as powerful as secondhand smoke. In other words, that it's a major contributor to health outcomes.
Yeah, toxic interactions are high-stress interactions. For example, a boss who insults you or yells at you continually, and you feel helpless and continually upset, or a family member who triggers you continually in the same range. In other words, it's typically, it turns out that all the kinds of stresses, psychological stresses, the worst are social stress. And that means that relationships that are in that sense toxic keep the HPA axis at a chronically high, and the HPA axis, if it's chronically high, undermines some crucial immune functions and, of course, also can create havoc with the cardiovascular system. And if it's extremely high, as in outright trauma, it also can, destroy cells in the hippocampus, shrink the hippocampus, which creates problems in attention and memory and so on.
How, at the individual level, suppose that one has a sense that one does not have the sort of social intelligence response that one wishes one had. What are the tools that social neuroscience suggests with which we can expand or enhance our capacity to respond in ways that are both healthy for us and healthy for those around us?
Well, the good news about social intelligence and emotional intelligence is it's learned and learnable, and that's why there's a huge focus on social-emotional learning programs in schools. Illinois has now mandated this education for every school, every student, every school, K through 12. New York has just done the same. Other states are doing it. And a huge meta-analysis about to be published shows that if you teach this to kids, they not only exhibit signs of these intelligences, but you have huge drops in risk factors like violence and substance abuse. Kids like school, there's less missed days, fewer dropouts, and academic achievement test scores go up 18 percentile points. It's pretty astounding. That's for kids, but remember that window closes in the mid-20s. So what about adults? And there, you still can make the change, but you have a double task, because if you want to become, say, a better listener, because you realize you have bad listening habits, you always multitask when you're with someone else, if not outright on a computer and email in your mind, and you realize that that's not full presence and you want to get better at being with someone with full attention, you need to, first of all, care. You need to be motivated, because it's going to take time and effort. But there is a learning paradigm that will help you. It's a different model of learning than academic learning, because you're dealing with other parts of the brain that learn through modeling and they learn through practice. So if you decide you want to do that, you need to be mindful of situations where you have to override the old habit and employ the new one, and do that at every naturally occurring opportunity. And we have data that suggests if people do this for 3 to 6 months, the new way of doing it becomes the brain's default option. The connectivity and the new response, it becomes stronger than that for the old one, and they do it automatically. Mm. So there is hope if you follow the right learning paradigm.
An essential point in your book, you talk about the high road and the low road in social intelligence. And so could you say a word about that, and particularly about educating the low road and Paul Ekman's work with micro-expression training? I just thought that was a particularly fascinating point.
Well, the low road refers to complex circuitry that operates super quickly, very rapidly, automatically, and unconsciously. And, for example, the mirror neurons that that are activating us, the same brain areas that are activating the person we're with, that's low-road circuitry. It's automatic. It's quick. And it needs to be. If we had to think about it, it would be very clumsy, and we'd never get anywhere in an interaction. The high road connects to this circuitry intentional, aware, cognitive abilities from the prefrontal cortex, and this allows us to have second thoughts, to drive our low road in ways we want to go. In other words, it gives us a greater degree of freedom. And Paul Ekman has studied, he's the world's expert on facial expression and emotion. He studied what he calls micro-expressions, which flit across the face in about a 20th of a second, and they are low road. They're automatic, unconscious, and out of awareness, meaning they reveal how we actually feel in the moment, but we don't know that we are communicating that information. And he says most people, when they are given the opportunity to try to read microexpressions, do no better than chance. But he's developed a very simple training CD that lets anybody, I've taken it, anybody go from average, which I was when I got my baseline score to about 80 to 90% accurate in about 30 to 40 minutes. And the way he does it is very simple. He gives us something we never have ordinarily in life, which is feedback as to whether we were right or not. And it turns out that the circuits in the brain that read or that are used to read microexpressions are eager learners. And it suggests that with the right kind of training regimen, we can train the low road.
Thank you, Dan. I'm going to ask the operator to open up the circuits now so that others can join the conversation. Julia, is there any special thing we need to say to the operator to have that happen? Operator, do you hear us?
Thanks. That's good.
So are the circuits open now?
Yes, sir. All lines are now open.
Okay. Now, do we have to ask people who are not asking questions to put their phones on mute? Yes. So if you're not asking questions, and can put your phones on mute right now.
Recording after the tone. When you have finished recording.
Great. So let's open it up to questions. Any questions for Dan Goldman? Please say your name. Are there no questions, or are we having a technology blitz here? Hello? Dan, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear
okay,
you.
Okay, good.
Theo?
Theo. Theo Colburn. Welcome.
Theo Colburn.
Yeah.
Dan, do you have any particular chemicals in mind that you're looking at, these epigenetic characters that affect the gene?
Well, you know, Theo, I was hoping you folks would tell me, because I'm not a chemist, but I think it's extremely important that these be identified, because there clearly is an epidemic of dysfunction in the circuitry among younger people. Not all of it in the clinical range, often in the subclinical range, but it creates nightmares for parents, for the children themselves, for schools, and later for the workplace. And I think that one of the powerful things that Che could do would be to frame some of your own findings in terms of problems like this. That is to say, of course, the big one would be autism, and there's a huge question about that. Why is it just a fluke that autism seems to be on the rise? Are we just diagnosing it better? Or is there something in the environment, a chemical, as many people are hypothesizing, that may be interfering with the proper development of the circuitry? And not just in the case of autism, but attentional deficit disorder, cognitive dysfunction, behavioral problems. Here's a data point for you all. There is a fellow at the University of Vermont named Thomas Achenbach who does a national random sample of 3,000 kids, completely representative of the entire demographic, evaluated by their parents and teachers. He does it every 12 to 15 years. And between the mid-70s and the late 80s, he found a huge drop in kids' abilities in this domain. And then he did it again in the late 90s, around 2000. He found that there had been an uptick for some reason. And I was wondering if there was something that was massively out of control in terms of chemicals in the environment that started to be regulated in, say, the early 90s, and if that might be related to this pattern. But that's just one of the kinds of things. If you could fill in the pathways that lead to any of these kinds of problems in kids, it would grab everybody's attention. And this is something else I had wanted to say, so let me use this as a platform. I don't know about Che itself, but the environmental movement generally, it seems to me, has gotten very cognitive, very scientific, and dry in making its case, even on global warming, and of necessity, because you need a good, sound scientific case. But it becomes so abstract from people that I would like to see that information packaged in a way that was less dry and had higher emotional impact.
Mm-hmm, yes.
For example, I live in what's called the Pioneer Valley in Massachusetts, Amherst, Northampton. It's a little bowl, and the wind comes from the south and the west, and it happens that there's a dinosaur coal-burning electric generation plant right on the hill that blows into the valley. And it also happens the valley has an extraordinarily high rate of child respiratory disease, and the local the head pulmonary specialist at the local hospital is really up in arms about this, and he sees that the power plant is a huge part of this problem. No one has connected the dots. If we were able to say to people in that valley, that plant you pass every day on your way to work is giving your kids asthma or is chronic pulmonary disease, and you can do something about it. That's the second thing. The first thing is the data, the dry facts. What does science tell us? What is the pathway here? What's the causal trajectory to your family? Some problem that exists in your family. I say your family because that's the emotional impact. And once you have everybody's emotional interest that way, then what can you do about it? Because if you just tell them what the problem is, like Al Gore's movie was all problem-focused, people can feel helpless and defeated rather than energized and activated. So along with that information that this power plant is giving kids asthma, I'd like to know what we could do about it.
Let's keep directly on target with Dan's question. Theo, let me give you just a first response opportunity. Do you have a comment on Dan's question?
And we are collecting data, and as it comes in, anything that looks like it interferes with development or function.
Yes.
And we are building huge databases.
And you have some publishable results?
Well, I have a paper that came out at the beginning of 2005 on neurodevelopment and pesticides.
Wonderful. I mean, I'm terrible, but wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, we just then went out on repro. But we are focusing on what we call our fetal origins of disease or disorder databases. And we have one on autism, ADHD, diabetes, which we are slowly adding the data to. And we will have those kinds of packages available for grassroots and support groups.
Wonderful, wonderful. But let me ask you this. Let's say that you find that a constellation of chemicals and pesticides are at cause, to some extent, in something like ADHD. What can parents do?
Let's stay on that point. Does someone want to respond to Dan's question on that?
Hi, what you're talking about now is pretty much what our book is about.
Wonderful, wonderful.
We're trying to have the scientific data and at the same time push the emotional buttons.
So you're doing case reports or things like that?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Specific kids, specific
families. Yep. Wonderful,
specific.
Wonderful.
But the real problem is with the science. That the science is rarely definitive. And even if it comes close to being definitive, as you know, there's this whole new industry about manufacturing doubt by industry. That challenges the science, challenges it all the way into the courts. And there's lots of tools in the courts to keep good science down. So while there is a lot of evidence out there, the demand for absolute proof is hard to meet.
Let me just comment here that at the autism conference at UC Davis the last few days, Herb Needleman, who's one of the great scientists in the field and did the original or much of the most important work on lead over the last three decades, and he traced the evolution of the science on lead from either you have lead poisoning and it'll kill you, or if it doesn't, you're okay, the earliest science, to the recognition that these kids had severe deficits, to the impact on IQ, and then good science on the relationship to aggression and behavioral disorders with high lead levels as opposed to low lead levels. Mm. And then the most recent science suggesting that fetal exposure to very low lead levels can lead in rats to the precursors of Alzheimer's disease at the end of life. So lead is perhaps the best documented, maybe somebody else wants to correct that, but perhaps the best documented response to your question. And in terms of the massive movement that you described and then the uptick, it would be interesting to correlate that with the history of getting lead out of gasoline, because that has been linked epidemiologically in terms of correlation to decline in a number of behavioral variables at a population level.
What are some other than aggression? Impulsiveness?
Charlotte Brody, can you help me on this? Anybody?
Aggression, impulsiveness, learning deficits, lack of, decrease in social interaction skills.
Oh, really?
And IQ are just some of the easier markers. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to, and we know the most about lead, but it seems like mercury and other metals.
Is there much known about mercury, by the way?
More every day. And part of the emerging story of autism is that most of us have the ability to metabolize and eliminate mercury. And so if you look at population-wide studies, it doesn't seem to be much of a problem. But for the subsection of children, we're now finding biomarkers in this extraordinary new work that really just wasn't possible 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Biomarkers that suggest that for a small subsection of children, mm-hmm. Metabolizing mercury just doesn't happen efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
And so for this small subsection of kids, a little bit of chemicals, especially metals, matters a lot more.
And how does it show up behaviorally or otherwise?
Well, there's some pretty good evidence in the work of Jill Jane. Is it Jill Jane or Jane Jill?
Jill Jane.
That for this subpopulation of children, the mercury in vaccines can be a trigger for autism.
Hmm.
But I wanted to get back to what you were saying originally and just sort of make two comments and hear your response.
Sure.
One is that, and this goes to what Phil was saying as well, is that the brilliance of your work, I think, in part, is that you're talking about subtle factors. You're not saying this is the cause,
no,
the singular
right.
cause,
sure.
but that this adds up with other predispositions, genes and genetic
exactly.
expression, nutrition, everything else to matter in the way human beings act
right.
and their ability to respond to stress.
Exactly.
And I think that Phil's point, that the legal system and the science system that in a way flows from the legal system that we have now requires a definition that really treats all disease as if we're looking for the single bacteria that causes the disease, the one factor, and that your work, I think, really adds to this emerging conversation about that's always the wrong question, and gets, I think, to your answer, which is what can parents do is, which of all of the factors are preventable, or if harm has already been caused, the harm can be diminished, and not that this is cure, but that this...
Exactly.
And just then one more point is that when you responded to Michael's question about the way parents respond to children, helping to define how they react as adults.
Mm-hmm.
There's some gender patterns in what you're talking about. I wonder if you'd talk some about that. And also about saying that the environmental movement has gotten very cold, I think that's a response to being told that we're much too emotional and girl-like.
Oh, that's interesting.
And
well, there is a gender politics whenever you speak the word emotion, actually. And the easy assumption is that it's that women would tend to be more emotionally expressive, for example, which they tend to be, but it doesn't necessarily mean that women tend to be more anxious attachment types. Interestingly enough, men tend to be less attuned to emotions, but it's not necessarily men who are avoidant. So I don't know where to go with that part of it, of what you're saying, but I also think that there is a balance in communicating a powerful message which can mobilize emotion. And Phil, of course, is one of the great journalists and can do this so well. It's almost a journalistic trick where you start with a powerful story and then you unpack the science that goes with that story. And what you do is deliver both the emotional punch and the cognitive punch too, which is the data behind it. And I like your point that because we're talking about complex biological systems and behavior as an emergent property of a complex biological system, that it's never just one thing. We're talking about additive risk factors and complex interactions. But I think, Phil, there may be a way to frame the science here where, even though we don't know everything about it, this is one thing that seems to add to the problem as a risk factor. Just as, you know, if your kid smokes, it adds to the lifelong likelihood of certain diseases. And as a caring parent, there may be things you can do in this realm, just as you would tell your kid, you know, not to smoke. In other words, I don't think we have to be completely defensive about the corporate legal machine that demands proof of a single explanation, but can still deliver the message that the science says these things seem to matter in this way. Here's the precise information. Here's a case in point. And also, if you cared about this in your family with your child in your town, here's something you could do. At least I hope that's true.
Phil, do you want to respond to that? I think that's a very good suggestion. And we are, you know, talking about lifestyle of the family and a lot of additional factors besides toxics in the environment. Problem is, you know, when you get down to taking this stuff out of the environment, those arguments tend not to get the trick done. At least that's been our experience in, you know, in the case history we've been looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're trying to get optimistic.
We have a email question from Steve Heilig, Dr. Goldman, regarding your question, what can parents do on autism or other chemically linked condition? The concern is twofold: care for those afflicted and prevention. Regarding the latter, it's been very hard to sell the concept of prevention, precaution, the needs of the future. Any thoughts on how best to convey concern for future generations in a socio-political context?
Interesting. My first thought as a grandparent is to focus on grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
Because grandparents are people who are at the peak of their influence and power.
Mm-hmm.
And yet care about future generations by definition.
Very interesting.
And I would love to see a campaign that said, you know, Grandpa and Grandma, think about your grandchildren. Here's what we know about what's happening to the world they're going to have to live in, and here are some things that would make it a better world. And by the way, I think that the most powerful lever that the environmental movement has is health and the environment, because it is so personal and so potent. And the positive way to frame it is in terms of green chemistry. The negative way to frame it is in terms of the poisons in our environment. But the solution, it seems to me, green chemistry, whatever that might entail. That was a phrase I first heard from Michael, and I thought, wow, that would be a wonderful title for a book on that topic.
Mm-hmm. And green chemistry is one of our central interests.
Michael, this is Kathy Sessions. I wondered if I could ask a question. I'm the coordinator of the Health and Environmental Funders Network, and one of the things that the foundations and the groups working in this field struggle with is that the news that the community has to deliver to the public about the extent to which pollutants and chemicals are in people's bodies and news about what the emerging science suggests this means for human health are quite disturbing. And
mm-hmm.
I wonder if you look at a population that might be scattered across your coping styles, anxious avoidance being two out of the three, what does it mean to, and if we care about the social and mental well-being of the public to whom we're trying to deliver these messages in an effort to mobilize social change, how best do we deal with the fact that people are at varying levels of ability to receive bad news and that they deal with it very differently?
That's a really good question, because avoidance will deny. That's their coping mechanism. So there's a famous case, I can't tell you who it is, there's a famous high-profile cognitive scientist who denies that there is any connection between parenting and life outcomes.
Any connection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then if you know the person, you understand why. So that's just to say that, yes, there are people who will be numb to whatever you say because they're numb.
Right.
On the other hand, that's about 20% of people in the general population. There are people who will seize on it because they are overly reactive. They may be your activists. That's about 25% of the population. And then there's the large middle, about 55% of people, who can be mobilized because they take in information more evenly and can read risk and take action from that secure base. I actually don't think you need to pay much attention to that system of styles in communication. I would go for the broad range and let people take it as they can.
And some of the things that you mentioned that suggest that there are things that can be done at different stages of life to help the circuitry repair or create new opportunities,
yeah.
I think we could be part of a really hopeful message.
Well, I think the hopeful message is to the grandparents for the grandchildren. Let's make the world. Let's get that stuff out of our grandchildren's environment, before they become like us. Maybe leave out the "become like us" part.
Other questions?
Carol here, Pat from Karma Wheel, and my question has to do with the fact that I think this is very troubling and news to deliver the population. And I'm wondering whether some of the Kubler-Ross's stages of hearing about death might be somewhat appropriate, because I think people need to have a space to hear the news, to honor it, to be sad, to be angry, and then move forward into action. But I think there does need to be almost a space for people to react, because they will be thinking about the fact that they would wish their child had the same chance not to contract asthma, for example, as children of previous generations that weren't exposed to these chemicals. I wonder what you think of that.
Yeah, I think that you need to, well, it would be artful to deliver that information to different cohorts according to their life station, predicament, and ability to do something. So, for example, on the one hand, I'm a grandparent, so I have a lifelong accumulation. I just found out my tissue levels of mercury are very high. So now what do I do? We have all of the PCBs and so on that we're going to get for a lifetime almost. You know, we get more daily. So what does that mean for us? That's a different conversation, and I think it's delivered in a different way, maybe different modalities even, than you know, I'm a grandparent, and I would like my kids to be as grandchildren be as healthy as they can. What can I do to make the world more safe from chemical contaminant point of view? So you could, if you were able to be more sophisticated about it and had the capacity to deliver messages to different segments of the population, you could target the message in different ways. And I think it's a point well taken that some of it we just have to sit with, register, be angry, be scared, be whatever, and then go from there.
Dan, we're in the last couple of minutes of the call. It's been extraordinarily rich, and I'd like to ask you, in the epilogue to your book, What Really Matters, you talk about Martin Buber's concept of I-Thou and the singification of people. You talk about George Herbert Mead, an early 20th century philosopher, who proposed the single greatest goal for social process was, quote, a perfected social intelligence with greatly heightened rapport and mutual understanding. And you talk about the Kingdom of Bhutan and its concept of gross national happiness. And I wonder, do you have a copy of the book with you?
I don't, I'm afraid.
Okay. I wondered, well, let me just, I want to read, because you don't have it, I wished you could read it, but you end the book with a quote from the poet Walt Whitman. In his exuberant anthem, I sing the body electric, and you say, he put it lyrically, I have perceived that to be with those I like is enough, to stop in the company with the rest at evening is enough, to be surrounded by beautiful, curious, breathing, laughing flesh is enough. I do not ask any more delight, I swim in it as in a sea. There is something in staying close to men and women and looking on them, and in the contact and odor of them that pleases the soul well. All things please the soul, but these please the soul well. So your final quote is from W.H. Auden, who pungently prophesied, we must love one another or die. So you actually, in that last section, make a real argument that this social neuroscience creates a really solid base for moving beyond the personal to a societal effort to build compassion. Could you say a little bit about that?
Well, what's encouraging in the science is the discovery that the compassionate response seems to be the natural one, that if we attune to a person and feel with, then the natural response is, if we sense distress or need, to act for. Well, that's the way we're wired. The civilization and its discontents gets in the way. So, for example, we may hear about kids starving in Darfur on email and be asked to punch in our credit card number. That's a very different part of the brain. But what this says is that if we sense human need, our innate wiring wants us to act for. And I actually think that that is a very hopeful message for all of the folks that are doing the work you're doing, because in a sense, what you're doing is raising an alarm. And I think if that alarm is heard in the right way, good things can happen.
Dan, thank you very much. I think this has been one of our best partner calls, and we're all deeply grateful to you. Julia, do you want to say a word about when the next partner call is? Do we have that?
Yeah, sure. Our next call will be scheduled for December 12th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, and the topic of that call will actually be autism and some of the factors that can cause autism. And I will email information about that call in the coming weeks.
And Martha Herbert from Harvard is our primary presenter, and she is one of the architects of this new paradigm of autism, so it follows very directly on this conversation with Dan Goldman. Again, Dan, our deep thanks for taking the time to do this.
Well, my deep thanks to all of you for the good work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
I am cutting.
Bye.
Bye.